What's the first thing I want to do after we have a different president? Take a shower.
Impeachment is about cleansing the office.
Now, mind you, the heretofore document had dry ink on it for at least many fork nights
We signed it a long time ago.
It was a long time ago signed.
I thought you said the law was powerless.
Powerless to help you, not punish you.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 350. What a nice landmark number. 350.
Well, if only there was a year zero, we would have a fancy new introduction.
Confusing. But no, new introduction next episode. So patrons, hop on, get your quotes suggested. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. Excited about today's episode.
As always, I'm always excited. I'm in a constant state of excitement about our episodes. We have an interview with Chris Armitage, who is a candidate for Washington's 5th Congressional District, challenging a very Trumpy person who we'll talk about later. Yeah. So that's going to be fun. I'm excited for that. Let's see. Any announcements? A lot of awful movies coming at you very soon. Go to Patreon.
Super excited about that. And I think it's very cool that a candidate for office is an OA listener. So I can't wait for our interview.
Awesome. All right. Well, then why don't we get Chris on the line? And we are now joined by candidate in Washington's 5th Congressional District, Chris Armitage. Chris, how you doing?
Really great. I appreciate you having me on. I've been a fan for a while.
All right. Cool. Well, back at you. We're rooting for you.
Yeah, we're kind of like the Rudy of congressional campaigns. Like, you really want to see us in the fight, you know? Just everyone wants to see it as long as we can raise enough money.
Is that the best analogy? I mean, because I'm pretty sure that kid got killed, right? Like,
that's fair.
But seriously, as a little background, I mean, why don't you tell us a little bit about your district and about the incumbent, which I think OA listeners will probably recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. So our district is a pretty interesting place. It's 25% bigger than New Jersey. Has 10 counties, but more than half the population is in one of those 10 counties. So it's economically diverse. Some of our counties have 30% of the people there under below the poverty line. So that's triple the national average. Wow. We have massive unemployment and underemployment. While the Trump administration brags about the unemployment numbers, we have counties that have 10, 12% unemployment. And those are the actively unemployed folks. So, and then beyond that, you know, our housing costs are rising. There's a lot of challenges out here. We have a Native American reservation called the Midnight Mine is a thing out there. There's uranium that was just left out there. And so cancer has completely devastated that community. It's a lot of the poorest counties in Washington state are right here in eastern Washington. So a lot of folks left behind. Our incumbent, Kathy McMorris Rogers, she votes with Trump 95% of the time. She's actually the chair of his Washington State Fundraising Committee. Our district is only +9 red, so that they shouldn't feel so comfortable or like it's a stronghold. They really shouldn't, because, you know, she hasn't had a serious challenger. She's been around since 2004, and most years, it's kind of seen as a sacrificial lamb place to run, where folks will jump into the race and walk it, not run it. And then get offered some sort of a good position with the state or with the party. Now, I'm a unique challenger for her as well. She loves to talk about how much she loves veterans and how patriotic she is. Well, I served in the Air Force at our Air Force base here in our district, Fairchild, for 2 enlistments. I deployed to the Middle East as security forces, where I did security on the Iraq-Kuwait border and on the Oman Emirates border, where I was a base defense operations controller. While I was active duty, I also earned a master's in homeland security and an undergrad in criminal justice and did law enforcement when I was stateside.
Wow. So, well, that I definitely want to delve into those questions because obviously I think you're prepared for us to ask 1 or 2 foreign policy questions, given the state of the world today and the fact that the United States has carried out an assassination in Iran. I don't want to lose. I guess I want to stay on the thread of the district for just a little bit. You said that it is an R+9 district. I've seen, you know, right around in that area, which seems to be kind of the sweet spot on Hofeller modeling for gerrymandering a district. I don't know, like when you look geographically at your district, does it strike you as gerrymandered? Have the boundaries been recently sort of redrawn, or did it just kind of happen that way that it falls into that category of almost always safe, but could be underwater in a wave election year?
This district is definitely, it's because there's 2 congressional districts that cover more than half of the state when we have 10 congressional districts. So they're not really too gerrymandered. They could flip them a different way if they wanted to help them lean blue for sure, and guarantee one of them would be blue and one of them would be red. But as it is, it's not too bad. Washington might be a pretty blue state, but something I really try to let people know too is we need to cast the net wide. We need to fight every single race we can, especially somewhere like here. And by the numbers, we should have been able to win this district before. We actually had a Speaker of the House who was a Democrat from this district. He had it from 64 to 94, Speaker Foley.
Sure.
And the DCCC put us on the red to blue list in 2018. So that seems like it'd definitely be possible with higher voter turnout in 2020 that we should be able to flip it.
Great.
Yeah, you talk about 94. I mean, that was the key to the kind of the Republican, I don't know, takeover of the House, right? Was challenging everywhere. So, you know, it's good to hear that you're going to be a part of that effort going forward. Challenging everywhere, I think, is really the lesson that we should have learned by all that.
Yeah, and they've been at it for a long time, and it was a big upset, obviously, for a speaker to lose their seat, especially since he was pretty beloved in this district. But we can take it back, and I think it's going to be pretty poetic for it to happen in 2020 after last time it was flipped in 1994.
Well, I think we're rooting for you. I want to talk about some of the specific strategies that you have. But why don't we pick up on that thread, right? You described your national security background, right? Which is right. It's always good to shore up sort of where you know your opponent is. Has a political line that maybe isn't necessarily borne out by the policy votes, right? Like we just discussed on Friday's episode, the Fifth Circuit's decision to allow Trump to raid $3.8 billion in authorized military spending and under the guise of a national emergency, redirect it to the big, dumb, impractical border wall. So that, you know, that's going to come out of direct military authorization. It's going to be stolen from, you know, couch cushions and pensions and the like, which doesn't seem pro troops to me. But leaving aside the editorializing there, why don't I get you to weigh in on the Trump ordered drone strike killing General Soleiman in Iran? Describe your position on that, your position on the legality, and what you would do in Congress in response.
Well, and I'll say too, as far as folks, possibly changing their views, you know, in the military, you see what he does. I never doubt the depth of human delusion. People throughout history have experienced far worse things. Folks under in the USSR under Stalin, were literally resorting to cannibalism, and they would just hate and blame whoever he told them to hate and blame.
Let's pick. I'm sorry, I got to pick on that one on a bit of a rabbit trail. I mean, that's Thomas is sometimes Negatron, but that's pretty pessimistic. I mean, you were there, right? You were deployed. You were in the armed forces. You know, what's your view of the degree to which the Republican Party and Trump specifically have, you know, co-opted, you know, propagandized, persuaded, you know, our military.
Yeah, well, and that probably sounded negative, but, you know, I don't even need a, you know, any view on this beyond what the polling shows. The majority of folks in the military, particularly officers, are not fans of Trump. They can see him for especially the terrible leader that he is, and plenty of enlisted folks that I know. We're taught what good leaders are, and he is not one. Blaming other people when you make mistakes and taking credit for other people's successes, that was what we were taught every day. It more surprises me that anyone in the military can go through that leadership training and see him as anything other than a weak, cowardly person.
So how would you reach out to service members then?
Well, some folks are going to be a lost cause, but you know, a big thing we do on this campaign when we see, you know, MAGA folks at protests or even you know, white supremacists at protest, you know, we ask them how they're doing, wish them well. We were at a protest recently, and there was a neo-Nazi there. This is a hotbed for armed white supremacy. In the whole country, right here in Eastern Washington, we actually have a state representative who was named by the FBI as a domestic terrorist. He wrote a manifesto requesting or telling people that we need religious warfare, and that any man who is pro-choice should be killed. And there are a lot of armed white supremacist militias out here, and they show up at protests that we're at. And, you know, I remember being at one and seeing this woman who was probably about 88 years old and maybe 4'10". And she was standing face to face with this 6-foot tall neo-Nazi guy, swastika on his hands, shouting each other down. And, you know, as former law enforcement, I tried to talk to him, too, and tried to get things to calm down. But then we all got showed up. My deputy campaign manager walked over and said to the neo-Nazi, "Hey, bro, do you want a hug?" And the neo-Nazi was like, "Sure, all right." And they gave each other a hug. And then the neo-Nazi put his MAGA hat, you know, down by his side and said, "Well, you can't impeach somebody because you don't like them." And then grumbled off and left. And that was what diffused it and what got the guy to leave. And so at these protests, when we see these people, we're nice to them. That's really the best solution I have. I don't know if it's the right answer. I just know it's what stopped violence, and they're happier when we yell at them. So maybe that's not the most effective tactic.
I love that story. I promise I want to get back to the Iran question. Why is rural Washington sort of the hotbed of armed, you know, neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups? I've never heard that.
Yeah. A lot of people are surprised, and there's a few different reasons. We actually received intelligence briefs about this when I was doing security at our Air Force base about different groups out here, like one of your favorites, Sovereign Citizens. They're also out here. And, you know, we're close to Idaho, and Idaho's had the same issues. Over the last few decades, it's just been seen as a good place to camp out and do paramilitary training. And so that's really, you know, for a long time, they've just been inviting other folks out here and using this as training grounds, cheap land, a lot of, you know, open room to roam, more privacy out here. So, you know, it's tough to nail down one specific reason, but we're fighting back. That's the thing. And also, by the way, my opponent saw that state representative's endorsement and received it and had it on her website.
Let me do one follow up on that, which is, other than the hugging them at rallies, which I love. I got to tell you that story is just, that's so endearing to me. Do you favor any kind of public policy action with respect to sort of growing organized white supremacist groups, neo-Nazis, that sort of thing? What is there anything you would do legislatively in Congress with respect to them?
I don't know if we really need new laws to address it. I think we need to update the education system and also how we hire law enforcement officers. I've met many people in this district who, when they were young, you know, they were young white men and they were approached by these groups and they tried to recruit them. And something these groups do is they actively try to get their members to become law enforcement and to become military. And at a lot of our protests, laws aren't enforced against them. We have something out here called I won't give away their name. I don't want to give them free press, but they set up a church outside of a Planned Parenthood so that they're allowed to be there, and they just harass everybody going into it. And that state representative is closely associated with them. And but, you know, when I mention all these people, too, I want it to be clear. We'll have 500 people at our impeachment rally or 2,500 people at our climate strike. And there will be 20 or 30 of these people who the other people, the people, the white supremacists and the MAGA folks, they are they're a very vocal but small subsect of our area. But yeah, it's really just going to take better hiring practices for our law enforcement and better education.
Yeah, well, perhaps we should move on from them and not let them get any more airtime with their nonsense.
That's fair.
Let's get back to Andrew's question about Iran. Do you have, again, views on what went down and what you would like to see done in the House if you're a congressman to maybe check the president's power?
Yeah, and of course, you know, I support what Senator Sanders and Khanna are working on. Now, personally, my view on how we stop all these forever wars is a little bit different than what a lot of people are talking about. One, we need to have the government entirely divest at every single level from military-industrial complex-related organizations. Also, we need to comply with the International Criminal Court, which gives up a degree of our sovereignty military-wise. And I believe that any United States president, anyone at any level of this government who sends our troops somewhere and participates in torture and other war crimes and crimes against peace, they should be held to those standards. If you can't pass the Nuremberg trial standards that put Nazis away, you deserve the same fate. And it's, you know, it's responsibility at the highest level. If we're going to move forward as a country, we need to actually hold ourselves to the highest standards. And for a long time, we've run roughshod over all other countries, all these other countries. And the people who send us to these wars, they go jet skiing. They paint in their free time. They have nice retirements. While, you know, our streets out here, homelessness is a big problem. And so many of these folks are veterans. And they come back and they don't have the resources they need. They end up turning to substance abuse or alcohol. So that's how we stop it. That's why, you know, as far as Iran, we killed, you know, one of the highest ranking people in another country for another country's government. It's not the same as killing Osama bin Laden. We invited him for a parlay. The United States can never be trusted again to have a peaceful discussion because we had the Iraqi president invite him and then killed him at the airport. So it's disgusting. It's terrible. And like I said, I'm a member of Veterans for Peace, and I'm speaking to people who were in Vietnam and the Gulf War and Iraq and Afghanistan. And we're asking ourselves, how do we stop this? I'm friends with other veterans who are progressives running for the House. And we ask ourselves, how do we stop this? I remember being at a protest in 2005 with my older brother, where we were marching down a major street and doing everything we could to combat the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, to get them to stop. And it didn't work. So how do we get it to change this time? We have to hold politicians accountable.
So let me push back and try and steel man the administration's position as much as possible. You've described this is a challenge, but you've described kind of escalation related harms, right? It would be really bad to go to war with Iran. Assume, based on the statements that we have coming out of the Trump administration after the latest round of Iranian strikes on U.S. military bases in Iraq, which, as far as we know, as of the time of this record, there were no American fatalities associated with that. And we're from my perspective, I don't know if you've heard, please let me know if you have additional intel. Everything I've read is that our intelligence agencies are, at least in terms of their public facing side, have not determined whether that was deliberate, right? In other words, whether Iran was sort of pulling its punch in response, or, you know, whether it was just fortuitous that that there were no fatalities. But assume that this doesn't escalate, right? Assume that it ends where it is, which is that, you know, Trump was able to assassinate somebody that, as far as we can tell, Mike Pompeo has been agitating for us to assassinate for months. Iran retaliated, did damage to materiel, but no fatalities. And then imagine, you know, it sort of simmers out. Is there still sort of a unique harm in this particular situation? Like, how do you view the situation, assuming no escalation, I guess is my question.
You know, if someone decides to drive 100 miles per hour and blow through a stop sign and they don't get hit, I don't know if I call that a victory. And that's really what I see this as. If more violence was the key to peace, we wouldn't have been at war for the last 19 years. And so that's really my answer to that.
Yeah, no, that's fair. You sort of mentioned the broader wars in the Middle East. You know, what do you have concrete plans, steps that you would take if elected in terms of, you know, minimizing in terms of bringing those wars to a close? Or, you know, what would you do? Let me not ask it as a leading question. Sorry, I'll step down the lawyer hat a little bit and just ask it as an open ended. You know, what would you do? What would your priority? What would your legislative priorities be?
Well, no, I appreciate you being clear. I know you like to be clear. You know, in my eyes, we have to go upstream, and this really guides a lot of my policy proposals, of which also I have some original ones that I really look forward to bringing out, and have had some other representatives get on board for. Now, fortunately, there's a lot of pressure right now to end the AUMF and remove, you know, all these, or add safeguards, add rails to the president's ability to unilaterally wage war and to assassinate people. But my upstream answer is we need to make sure that it's not profitable to go to war anymore. You know,
what do you mean by that?
Well, it comes from complete divestment and rooting out a lot of the corruption in the military. I remember seeing flashlights that were made in China for our guns, and they cost about $5 to $10 to produce, and we were paying $250 for them. And I've known a lot of people who saw the blatant corruption in our military, because it's become a bottomless pit for people for self-enrichment. For a lot of our politicians.
Someone should come up with a phrase for that. Like, I don't know, like industrial military comp. No, something like that, though. Military, industrial.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, we need to have more safeguards. I think that it's not that we can't. It's that we won't, that we haven't. That we haven't up to this point. But we can. You know, we weren't always this corrupt. And, you know, my big thing is the incrementalism. Well, I've seen people things incrementally get worse. So clearly incrementalism hasn't worked. So reducing war powers of the president, reducing, you know, the ability and the lack of oversight for that allows corruption, auditing the Pentagon is one that especially my libertarian friends really like to hear me mention. Audit the Pentagon, audit the Fed, actually look at the books, you know, trillions of dollars go missing. And you know what? The people who are responsible for this, right now, they get to lead comfortable retirements. And that's part of what, like I said, you know, in Congress, what I hope to bring is accountability at the absolute highest levels.
Well, our three libertarian listeners, I think, are nodding along enthusiastically right there. Now, let me broaden that question a little bit. I had asked sort of what your top legislative priority would be with respect to foreign policy, with respect to the Iranian crisis. And, you know, you gave a systemic change answer. What if, you know, I'm going to ask you the congressional equivalent of the presidential 100 days, right? Like Chris Armitage elected to Congress on a platform to do sort of, you know, fill in the blank. What's your top legislative priority? What do you want to be known for?
Well, I think the most important one's campaign finance reform. Hmm. Yeah. So much stems from that. And I mean, it's amazing, you know, Senator Sanders really did something incredible in 2016 by showing viability of a campaign that didn't take corporate money. Now I'm on the 2020 slate for brand new Congress. For anyone who isn't familiar, that's one of the, they help working class candidates get elected. They're one of the first groups that found Representative Ocasio-Cortez and helped guide her campaign and help it grow. And they received about 30,000 applications and picked about 30 candidates, of which I'm one. And that's one of their core missions, is getting corporate money out of politics. If we do that, we can return to a place of substantive discourse where, you know, Eisenhower Republicans can actually do good things. You know, Nixon created the EPA, and you know, policies could actually be debated with an honest and sincere intent to find not, a middle ground that upsets everybody except for the 1%, but new and creative solutions that are fiscally responsible and take care of people.
So, let's drill down on that a little bit in terms of, because I obviously that is, you know, a lot of that is music to OA ears, as I think you well know. In light of Citizens United, what do you think Congress can do to try and eliminate or reduce the influence of corporate money in politics?
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of my answer on this has been influenced by listening to this show and learning a lot more about the Supreme Court and the makeup of our justices.
Well, flattery will get you everywhere, sir, but you still have to answer the question.
That's fair. So I'm actually proposing something called the Marketplace of Ideas Act. I chose that name really deliberately because I know that it should have some broad appeal. The Marketplace of Ideas Act intends to guarantee third and fourth party candidates ballot access at every single level of our government. I'm just looking for workarounds. We're looking to, with the Marketplace of Ideas Act, institute maximum caps on how much political campaigns can receive total. So even if you're entirely corporate funded, there's still a cap to how much you can receive. Another part of the Marketplace of Ideas Act, which, ruffles some feathers, is ending political TV ads. There's some people who aren't happy about that one, but in my eyes, we need to do everything we can to make sure that a message is what spreads of its own merit, and not just because someone has enough money to, you know, Michael Bloomberg the TV.
Yeah, I was watching the NFL playoffs last weekend, and I saw Bloomberg ads and Steyer ads, and it was just like, yep, that sounds right. Those are the... Those are the two candidates that I would expect to hear from on the NFL playoffs.
Those are my workarounds, you know, and exactly. I don't want people to be able to buy elections. So until we can have a Supreme Court that's more fair and just, those are, you know, that's a law, the Marketplace of Ideas Act, that I believe could at least hedge a lot of the problems that we're seeing right now.
Well, and feel free to punt on this because it's a tough question that we've been wrestling with on the show. But the last clause that you said is, you know, until we have a Supreme Court that is more fair and just, what are your thoughts? Obviously, that's an incredibly difficult situation, but I'd love to hear what thoughts you might have with respect to how to address the fact that, you know, even if there is a blue wave, which, you know, I think we all believe is coming and certainly hope is coming, you know, Donald Trump has substantially remade the federal judiciary, and that looks like an impending crisis. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, and now what, 25% roughly of our federal judges are now Trump appointees around there. Is that about right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's worse at the higher levels, right? Trump has appointed more courts of appeal judges in 3 years than Obama or Bush in eight, and just as many Supreme Court justices as both Obama and Bush. So, you know, it's 173 at last count district court judges, and again, also not just numerically, but distinctions in kind, right? That
yeah.
You're getting 32-year-old Federalist Society hacks who have never taken a deposition, argued a motion, and are unanimously rated unqualified by the American Bar Association. That's, you know, that's asymmetric warfare.
One of the main things I support, you know, from what would be my role in Congress, is a nonpartisan organization that evaluates the qualifications of future appointees. I think that's another guardrail we could put in there.
But let me ask about, I mean, in my view, the ABA is nonpartisan, right? Like it, how do you, in an era of Trump where, you know, you just have to say, oh, well, you know, Robert Mueller, lifelong Republican, and his, you know, lifelong Republican staffers are now all a cadre of Democrats. You know, how do you stop the noisy right from just calling your nonpartisan commission, you know, a cadre of crazy socialists?
Yeah, you know, I remember in, you know, we cannot really allow those people to decide what we're going to do. Whether it's I'm a constitutional hardball fan. I'm not going to let those folks decide what's right and what's wrong. That's what, you know, I do believe in bringing folks from the other side. I do believe in building bridges, but that doesn't mean I'm going to let people toss us around. I'm not going to let them try to destroy our sense of what's right and wrong or degrade our republic. I'm not interested in doing that. I'm not interested in allowing that. I'm not interested in standing for it. And I wish in Congress, part of why I'm running is because I think we need more table pounders, more people who are going to let these folks know, let people like Lindsey Graham know this is not okay. We know what right and wrong is. We know that, you know, Donald Trump deserves to be impeached. We know that his entire presidency has been one impeached offense after the other. And so we're not going to let you gaslight us. We're not going to let you obstruct us. If you're going to try, we're going to play the same. We're going to come right back at you. And we're going to do it with truth and with honesty and with integrity. And I think that wins. The problem, you know, in my eyes here, I think Democrats for so long have been focused on process instead of results. Well, and that is what has cost us 1,000 seats over 10 years.
Well, yeah, I would love to go down that rabbit trail with you. I think we are likely aligned or, you know, at least sort of on the same side in terms of our previous discussions on contest everywhere. And I don't want to pass lightly over the fact that, you know, we haven't rehearsed out these questions and answers, and, you know, it's nice to have a political candidate give direct, pretty unambiguous answers to tough questions. So I know we really appreciate that.
Let me ask a question here. We were talking about impeachment. I'm very curious how you're managing the idea of balancing talking about big national issues that seem to take over everything now. I mean, I've heard it said, and I've read that it does seem as though in today's media environment, in today's, you know, social media, internet environment, that while you are, of course, running for the House, you also have a district, and there should be issues that you would think would be very particular to your district. And I know you've mentioned a few of them, but it seems as though that's the fader, if you will, on, you know, how much do you talk about these local issues versus how much do national issues and talking about President Trump, how much the focus is and how much people at the rallies you're going to care about, you know, what you're doing for your district versus what, you know, what you're going to do to stop Trump. So what has been your view of that, being someone who's running for office in the year 2020? Are you able to focus in on local issues, on things you want to do to improve the quality of life in your district? Or is Trump just such a overbearing figure? Because in fairness, he's such a disaster and he's such a threat to everybody that, you know, it makes sense that we're focused on him. What's been your experience of that dynamic of balancing national issues versus issues that are very close to your district?
Yeah. So, you know, bringing it down to the personal level is really what helps us survive it. But the thing is, people can smell when you're equivocating, when you're dancing around things, when you don't want to say where you stand. And I found a lot more success by hearing people out, hearing what they have to say, and that's brought folks over. There's people who have my bumper sticker next to their Trump bumper sticker, and I tell them right to their face, you know, exactly the same thing I told you there. But what it comes down to is when they share their stories, and I make it clear that I'm someone who's not for sale. I'm not going to be bought and paid for. For example, I believe to attend public schools, there should be mandated vaccines. But when I meet, I met with a woman who it was actually on a libertarian friend's Facebook comment section, and she asked if I supported medical freedom, which I know is a buzzword for that or a dog whistle for that. And so I asked her if we could meet. We went to a public park. I met her kids. She talked about her feelings on vaccinations and why she's against them. And I let her know I disagree. But what I do believe, and what no other politician in this region is going to give, is that Big Pharma isn't funding my campaign. They don't get a seat at the table with me, and they're not going to be writing the laws that I pass, that I support. And that Venn diagram overlap is what helped us agree. Now, when it comes to the local issues, the fact is I go out in any community in this district and I hear horror stories about healthcare. And that's affected me. I was doing security on the Iraq-Kuwait border, driving around in an up-armored Humvee and helping my mom with her copays because she has lupus. And that's not really fair. And I knew that wasn't fair. And so when I bring those, those stories to folks, it connects, and they share theirs with me because we all have medical horror stories. And I think that's kind of the path forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a hobby horse of mine, but and forgive me, I don't want to turn into the candidate running here, but I really do have to ask perhaps a leading easy question. What does it mean to say that Republicans support the troops? Because I really don't know what that means. It seems to mean that they get really mad at Colin Kaepernick. Like, that's like the extent of supporting the troops. And then they send troops to their deaths and don't provide often don't provide good health care, or at least not good mental health care. It's that they sign bills into law that or rather sign trillions of dollars to build toys or to overpay for flashlights on the guns or something. But I don't see what that does to actually support the troops. So with that leading question, what would it mean to you to actually support the troops?
The mainstream media has tried to control what we talk about because they know that things like supporting the troops are going to be what divide us up at our Thanksgiving dinners. Supporting the troops means not sending them to war. We agree on that. And when I talked, I was a conservative friend of mine the other night. Whenever we meet up, I know he's going to come to me with a few very pointed questions. And he was, he was asking about this and about the Iran situation. And I just let him know I'm done with war. I've been there. I have friends who, one of my friends posted on Twitter the other day, a picture of his flak jacket and vest covered in blood. And it was his friend's blood. And we've been at war for so long. And that's part of why Tulsi Gabbard has so much bipartisan support, is because actually the vast majority of Americans don't want more war. Now, they're control or deciding what we talk about and what the conversation is important, because I think that's the path forward. When the mainstream media takes these divisive subjects, they know it's going to tear us apart because it's this ephemeral concept, support the troops. They've destroyed the real meaning of those words. But when you talk to people and you say, I don't want my friends to die anymore. I don't think this is worth it. I don't want any more of my friends to be in harm's way. And for so long, these forever wars have meant a flag hanging from a windowsill or a flag draped over a coffin. But more war increases our danger, and we can end up with it coming to this nation too. And it breaks through the Fox News bubble. That's the best I have. That's the best answer I have, is that you can break through the Fox News bubble, but it's about talking about your experiences and speaking honestly and from the heart. Low information voters are people, they're deciding with their gut, but I don't think that's a bad thing. If you really look at that, people are just trying to decide, who do I trust? And they might be wrong sometimes, because sometimes we trust the person who's the most confident, and that's not always the right person. But, you can either work with that or let it work against you.
When you, we mentioned at the top that you're in a R+9 district and that certainly seems attainable in a wave election. But who, in your mind and your campaign's mind, maybe is who's the target to bridge that gap? Is it about converting you know, Trump voters, or is it about, you know, what, like, for example, how is voter turnout in your district? And is that going to be the key? Is getting people who maybe were just sitting it out because they don't feel inspired or whatever? What do you see as the best route to bridge that gap?
Well, we have half a dozen colleges, and most of the students are from out of the area, and campaigns haven't been effectively to get those effectively been able to get those students to transfer their residency. We do mail-in ballots in Washington State. So staying on top of people and letting them know, hey, did you get your ballot? You know, we're working on text trees and text chains. We have a lot of student leaders. I'm younger than most of the people who've been in this race before. And so that helps too, connecting with those young folks. And honestly, I just meet people even in the most rural parts of this district who are tired of having politicians show up who won't say where they stand on things. And there's a lot of people across this district who are ready to vote for the first time ever.
I was just going to ask, does Washington have same day registration? Or
yes.
Okay. And so it sounds like your answers are very much on the mobilize previously non-voter side, as opposed to, you know, trying to win over maybe moderate Republicans. Is it a fair summary?
I mean, I hate to say we're doing both, but we are doing both.
All right. I knew you were going to give that.
We're holding town halls. We're going to some of the reddest areas in our district and saying, hey, you know, I've been told that I shouldn't come here and support the Green New Deal. But you know what? How many people in this room haven't had a job for at least a year? How many people in this room make less than $15 an hour? How many people in this room have had warnings not to drink the water in their community in the last 5 years? That's a thing that happens out here. Yeah. We're struggling with poverty, unemployment, underemployment. And whatever area you go to, these people are really hungry for some change. And so whether it's the young folks or the older folks, you know, they see, oh, well, this person's just being honest with us. And it's amazing how bar the low is, that's the quality that people admire in someone running. But I think this is a special time in U.S. history. You know, this is the first time you can run for office in U.S. history. And you don't have to say, you know, I'm a white man and here's my wife and kids and here's our church. You know, and in a lot of the country, you don't have to do that anymore. The times are changing. People are ready for honesty. They're ready for getting rid of political gamesmanship. Yeah. It wins you a lot more votes, a lot more people who say, I don't agree with, you know, what they have to say, but I think they're a good leader.
Okay. And, you know, you've woven in to some of your answers stories about protesting and marching going back from, I think you said to 2005. So, I mean, it sounds like you've been politically active for, you know, pretty much your entire adult life. But talk a little bit about how you made that decision to run for Congress. I mean, one of the things I always find really interesting, I love trying to share on the show, you know, we cover some pretty dark stories, but empowering people to feel like they can do something and can make a difference. And certainly, you know, a normal person of average means, I think was, you know, the pack you were describing. How did you come to run for Congress? Tell us a little bit about that.
I don't come from money or power. You know, my dad had a few different jobs, worked for the railroad, did HVAC repair. And my grandfather was a union delivery driver. And, you know, I remember being a kid and watching in 1999 when my dad got laid off and we were a family of five without health care and watching our car get repossessed through the screen window out front. But we were always really engaged in politics. That was from a very young age. We would have really intense discussions. I knew who Bernie Sanders was when I was probably 5 years old. But also from a young age, you know, my parents encouraged me and my brothers to share our opinions and form our own beliefs about, you know, how the world could be a better place. And when I joined the military, I was a little concerned that maybe they, you know, since we weren't big on war, I'd been out there protesting the same war I was about to go enlist in as security forces. But they were happy because they said he's going to have a living wage. He's going to have universal health care. He's going to have, debt-free college. And you know, so I did that thing. I went out, I got my education. I've always been involved. And when I left the military, I decided to pursue something I'd been doing for a really long time, stand-up comedy, and have done that professionally for the last 2 years. And I also, well, I'm 5'3", former law enforcement with two brothers who are both almost a foot taller than me. So I've had to get people to laugh to, avoid getting hit before. So, you know, comedy is something I love. And, when it came to getting involved in politics though, the bench isn't really deep out here in Eastern Washington. There aren't a lot of obvious establishment players to jump into a race, even a congressional race. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, and he said, who do you want to vote for? I know who you don't want to vote for, but who do you want to vote for? And I said, preferably someone young, someone, preferably a veteran, someone who knows what it's like to make minimum wage, someone who knows what it's like to be uninsured and underinsured, someone working class. He said, well, why don't you? And I said, oh, well, I can't. I'm working class and I'm an outsider and all these other things I admired. And that I, other these things I really wanted to vote for. The type of representative I always wished I had was just one of us, you know, like a straightforward working class person who really cares. Well, we have a full staff now. have a headquarters, and I people are jealous of my campaign manager, and they're like, how'd you get someone so amazing? And the answer is, and she's a single mother with 2 3-year-old twins, and was working in customer service before. And, you know, the answer is I didn't look at her resume. We've had an open door and tried to be a place where people can really grow and be straightforward and honest. And I'm the only Democrat in this race. We've got some really amazing endorsements, national endorsements, and local too. We've gotten some really great establishment nods, which is crazy. As a 27-year-old LGBT, never run for office before person, we're really building kind of a movement out here in Eastern Washington.
Well, that is inspiring, and thanks for sharing. If we have potential Chris Armitages listening in the audience and thinking, well, maybe I'd like to run for Congress, right? What would your advice to them be? Like, what's the first step? It's, you know, maybe too late for 2020, but you know, the 2022 cycle is going to be important. How did you get started? What was the first thing you did that for you felt like that, okay, now I'm doing something official to make this happen, to go from, you know, the conversation at the bar stool of, well, I was in Congress, I would do X, to which I'm making fun of myself there, right? I have those all the time. I mean, I have a show in which I do that, but to actually running, what's your suggestion?
Well, it's not the most exciting answer. Find out if you have a neighborhood council and go to that first. I mean, it's amazing some of the things I've seen voted on at neighborhood councils. Attend your city council meetings if you have them. If there's a seat that's open that nobody's jumping into, jump into it. Show up to organizations. There's so many nonprofits and volunteer-based organizations that I learned about over the last few years. And I realized, wow, if you just show up, you can actually really rise through the ranks. They need people really bad. They need reliable people, and they do great work. So it's also about more than just holding office. You can become a deeply influential person in your community if you just show up to the volunteer events, if you offer to staff a table for somebody, if you get involved or find an open seat, build those connections and be a positive force in your community.
Yeah, no, I love that answer, and I love reminding folks that, you know, oftentimes 90% is just showing up, and that it is doing the legwork and putting in the time, you know, with community organizations and groups. So I think that's great advice.
Can I give a shout out to some of our stuff?
Sure.
Excellent. So we're not taking a cent of corporate money. And, you know, we have a winning message out here, but it's going to take some work to get it out to every single person in this district. So if anybody has a chance to go to Act Blue, if you have an Act Blue account, it's Armitage, Armitage. And, you know, if every listener who heard this just threw in a few dollars, especially recurring monthly, we would topple Trump's Washington State fundraising chair. She is in a winnable district and has really betrayed the ideals of our nation, has betrayed the people of this district. And in Congress, I can be counted on as someone, you know, who hasn't taken corporate money and is here to support single payer Medicare for all and, you know, K through 16 education, aggressive climate action. And so I hope people are willing to cast the net wide and help us win everywhere possible.
Awesome. Solid pitch. We support you. Thanks so much for coming on. And we really do wish you the best of luck. And hopefully we'll be able to regroup later on once you're, you know, once you're in the House and we can correspond.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
And now it's time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats, since it is Top Patron Tuesday. And these are folks who are at the Hall of Fame level on patreon.com/law, enjoying all the goodies. Let's start with officially announcing OA live show in Minneapolis. man, if we left our tour schedule up to the patrons, Andrew, we'd be very busy, is all I'll say. And not very practical,
I don't mind,
but that's okay. Yeah. Increasing my pledge for the new year, and let's go Seattle live show. Let me be totally clear. I like Seattle live shows. This is, wow. All right. Ian Buckley, Jim, Ziegenhagen, oi, oi, oi.
That's excellent.
Adam Larson, Kristen Daniel, Al the Pal, Colleen Wilson, I'm P. Andrew Torres, and I approve this message. Murray Gregerson, Lufflecopter, India is shooting students protesting against bigotry. Can we get CERT to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3BE answers? Vote Bailey for first doc 2020. Absolutely. Seattle or Portland live show, I'll bring scotch. Crichton, unpack Rachel and get out the puncture repair kit. Bernie or Thanos 2020. That's an interesting ticket. Portland live show, Amber Green, clear eyes, full hearts, totally clear. Zirkel, Freudian faceplant. Not all Republicans are squirrels, but all squirrels are Republicans. Nobody expects the Seattle live show. Our chief weapon is surprise. Gosh, we better check what venue we get if we do that, Andrew. I mean, just from patrons alone, we could fill the seats, apparently. Emily Rainbow Spence, 3-11. Oh, here we go. So this, I guess, is March 11th, Sharks versus Hawks, March 12th, Chicago live show. Yeah, I'm in. I mean, the only team that's worse than the Hawks is the Sharks and vice versa. It's a terrible matchup. Unprecedented, resented, demented, president defenestrated. Jason Copas. NSFW is synonymous with OSHA violation. Rally live show. Will professionally sharpen Thomas's hockey skates. Hey, I sharpen my own skates, actually. Get a little sharpener. So don't need it, but thanks for offering. Looking forward to the Atlantis live show on Maritime Subsit Law. Michael Blevins running for Senate to replace Joni. Oh, we got to interview Michael Blevins.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is anybody who's running against the Republican. Definitely. Hotspear.com, open water, swim buoys keep you visible and your valuables safe. Shout out to the SGU Forums Politics subforum. You can make more money with a flop than you can with a hit. Dragonfly.eco, books about nature and the environment, reviews and interviews. Alec Emke, it's legal, it's advice, it's not legal advice. Michelle Cloud, Mongo, like Seattle live show. And Mongo, merely pawn in Game of Life. Isn't that what he says or something like that? Nate Drex, Stuff and Polls, Corso's Temporal Eatery, where your family can eat whenever they want. Seattle live show, will cook platinum dinner at my house. I have whiskey. Darth Mandypants, Umanum Brewing, 13th Century Saxony Gravel Truck Lawyer, The Mandarin, Pain Don't Hurt, Jennifer Kratch, Catherine Connell, Nightmare on Pennsylvania Avenue, Longtime Citizen, First Time Impeacher, A Series of Unfortunate McGovens, I'm Here Because Diogenes the Cynic Was Right, what? Huh? All right, we got a series of words, Above Wish, Dune Father, Insane Bracket, Voyage Live, Hobby Random, Focus Blossom. Okay, I don't know. I got nothing. Jeff Gelbach, Knocking Doors for Elizabeth Warren in Washington State. Ooh, nice. Vote for Chris Armitage if you're in that district. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio, the Registry Matters podcast. Mike Hudson got a new job, now OA sponsor. Nice. Andrea, the arbitrary and capricious. John Bilderback, for its 1, 2, 3,000 strikes, you're impeached at the corrupt intention game. And finally, get your unconvincing lobster coffee at the live show in Tacoma. Go ahead, Andrew.
Oh, lobster coffee. And thanks to Gerrymandering is an Abuse of Power, P. Andrew Tortoise, a plethora of pinata drones, and Norfolk, Nebraska, SummitShuffleboard.com. Wow, that's like three different shout outs all in one Patreon name, but hey, we'll do it. Chugga, 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 clownhornvoting.com. Not sure we endorse an odd number of chuggas, but Eric Alsman, Clownhorn the Live Show. I just want dinner in Seattle. Denver Live Show is likely to be hilarious. Not me. I'm a precious little cinnamon bun. So Payne Strumpet, Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Trambolus, Napoleon. Well, Kiwa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. The Wandering Gambler. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. The Howler Monkey Theory of Legal Interpretation is Pretextualism. Milo Meadsong suggests Tipping the Scales podcast. Oh, well, check it out. Adam Costa. Build the third shed, Arthur. Too many sheds is not even a thing. Excited about the Melbourne live show. That's actually on the whiteboard. Jay Aldenwalt. Our favorite karaoke legend, Cosmo Blues. That's true. You are. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Wax and Wayne, Lawman of the Roughs. I killed Ned Thompson. His body is under the shed. Wow. Apparently we're confessionals now, too. James Call, playing Cards Against Humanity without a full deck. No. Give me those sweet, sweet utils. Nice philosophers in space crossover. Anonymous, moving on to other jokes, but Chicago knife sharpening party is still on. All right. Mr. Tralala was the greatest Russian yodeler. Buttercup's Shed Construction Company offers discounts for third-time shed owners. Oh, that's good. Good job, Buttercup. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Closing concessions. It's a yodel stairmaster, and it never gets higher. When are the Bengolfi hearings? Derek, Denver will have our own live show with Blackjack and our deference. Just to be totally clear, I legitimately enjoy sports law segments. You know, I have two of them coming up, but I accept all the cookies. Big Easy Blasphemy, Sam Buck, a string of unpronounceable characters, David in Brooklyn, Rhonda, the Baked Alaskan. Oh. Good morning, Camp Quest, DC Live Show, or the Patreon pledge gets it. Ooh, well, whoa. You know, I think official OA policy is we will not negotiate with terrorists, but we're going to do a Washington, D.C. live show, man, dude. It's pretty convenient for one of us. It's super convenient for me. Malika Chandler, Abacus, Flinch, Soggy Pants, Greg Sullivan, Matthew Vernon, Adopt a Homeless Pet and a Post, Declawing and Ear Docking, Don't Take Ramp Building Advice from a Podcast, Heather L., Dwayne Dibley, that's such a great one. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Sam Danow, Ian and Allie, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Zabby, Alexandra Chalupa, a.k.a. Natasha Crunchwrap. That one still makes me laugh. Research Round Earth. Yeah, well, right. Mitchell, Brian, Punch It, Kim Jong-un, Chairman Un to my friends. I agree with that 100%. And of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels.
Also, obviously, Brian will only punch it when I tell him to punch it. He's, you know,
Oh, someone, did you think, I thought that was a shout out to you not trying to hijack your Brian punch it skills.
I'm just making very clear, I have security protocols installed in Brian's brain. One person can instruct Brian to punch it on this
I've
show.
Tried. I say, Brian, no, punch Andrew, it all the time.
I don't trust Andrew with that power. Are you kidding me? It's only... there can be only one. All right. Well, it's time to punch the keep punching at it and punching at it until we get the the bar exam question right. It's T3BE. Here we go. Brian, hit it. Just going to totally change it.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
All right, Thomas. This was a straightforward question. Congress enacted a statute prohibiting discrimination on the rental of residential property on the basis of sexual orientation or preference by any person or entity, public or private. Which of the following provisions provides the strongest basis for Congress's authority to enact this statute? You narrowed it down to the Enforcement Clause of the 14th Amendment or the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8. And I am here to tell you, Thomas, you got this one exactly right.
Yes.
It is, in fact, the Commerce Clause, the Enforcement Clause of the 14th Amendment. That was meant to be the attractive distractor, right? If you're just sort of looking through and you're your average person, you're like, oh, yeah, 14th Amendment, that's about equality and stuff. So I'm going to pick that one. And good job not picking that one, because the 14th Amendment's Enforcement Clause only applies to when Congress regulates state action. Right. It does not apply to private action. So in order to regulate private action, Congress has to have an independent justification for it. That is found in the enumerated powers in Congress in Article 1, Section 8. You kind of laughed at the promote the general welfare, but, you know, that's a thing.
No, I didn't laugh. Okay. I just didn't think it was it. I don't know.
Yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough.
It's a little too general.
The case law on the general welfare clause, right? That is, Congress has the power to make legislation to, you know, regulate commerce between the states. That's the Commerce Clause. And among other stuff, to promote the general welfare. That applies when Congress either taxes or spends money. Right. It does so under the rubric of the General Welfare Clause. But when it regulates, that's got to find a power somewhere else. This is neither taxing nor spending. This is a regulation. And the regulation is 100% constitutional under the Commerce Clause. Congratulations. You got it exactly right.
Nailed it. Yeah. OK, well, victory lap. Yeah, that was fortunate. All right. Well, I'm back on my way to still staying constantly at around 54% or whatever I'm at. But that's okay. Better than failing.
Exactly 54% with this. It's like 54.06%.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. I remember when I dreamed of 60.
We're on the right trajectory.
I'm too old now. I was back in my youth. I dreamed of 60%, but I'm past it. Your average professional lawyer, you know, is already out of the game by 29, right? Isn't that how it works? No, I don't. All right. Well, I got it right. Let's find out. Let's hop in our limited use time machine and find out who is this week's big T3BE winner.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is Ryan on Twitter, who says, see, Commerce Clause, rentals aren't person, place, thing in commerce. But being able to rent and live in areas has an aggregate effect on commerce in that area. That is exactly correct. And Ryan, a lot of people got this one right, but Ryan was the only person that we saw that really delved into sort of the specifics on the Commerce Clause analysis. He's exactly correct. And everyone should give at the Yarn McAkey, TheYarnMcaky, a follow on Twitter. And congratulations, Ryan, on being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much to our guest, Chris Armitage. You know, I really do believe in that challenge everywhere thing. And it's awesome that he's doing this. It's really cool, by the way, that he was only one of only 30 candidates to be selected by, was it Act Blue? Now I think that's what it was. But anyway, whichever thing he said, that's super cool. And it's an opportunity to take out a Trump supporter in that district. So.
A 97% Trump loyalist. I mean, you know, Kathy McMorris Rodgers is Matt Gaetz without the punchable face, right? Like, I mean, she's way up there. So,
yeah,
absolutely.
So awesome. Good on Chris. And we're rooting for him. So thanks so much for listening. We will see you folks for Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Open Arcs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Loveridge, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.